Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Nayman of Just Foreign Policy, who considers the unanswered questions on President Obama's escalation of the Afghan war as the U.S. launched a new offensive in the town of Marjah. Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig, who discusses his group's campaign to restore public trust in Congress by fighting the influence of money in politics. And Jane Slaughter, staff writer with the publication Labor Notes, who looks at the causes of growing anger among union activists upset with the direction of congressional Democrats and President Obama. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Growing fears over the future of democracy in Sri Lanka have emerged as President Mahinda Rajapakse, recently elected in a landslide, ordered opposition leader and former army chief Sarath Faneska arrested on charges of treason and conspiracy. Other high-ranking retired military officers have also been arrested. The arrests came as Rajapakse's ruling coalition is seeking a two-thirds majority in parliamentary elections this April. The supermajority would give the president nearly unlimited power to remake the country in the aftermath of the victory over the Tamil Tigers guerrilla movement last spring. The arrest and pending court-martial of Faneska, the lead military commander against the Tamil Tigers, came as the retired general expressed an openness to testify about alleged war crimes by Sri Lankan soldiers during the final offensive against the Tamil rebel group. The United Nations estimates 7,000 civilians were killed in the final months of the nation's civil war. A usually divided opposition united to mobilize a protest against the crackdown. Protesters faced off against pro-government militia and were broken up by police using water cannon and tear gas. Human rights groups like Amnesty International and governments promoting peace in Sri Lanka, such as Norway, France, and the U.S., all condemned the crackdown on the opposition. The right-wing blogosphere is still buzzing about Executive Order 12425, signed by President Obama in December. The one-paragraph order gives Interpol, the Paris-based international law enforcement agency, special privileges in the United States, such as an exemption from the Freedom of Information Act. TV commentator Glenn Beck, the National Review magazine, and former House Speaker Newt Gingrich have railed against this obscure order to fuel a right-wing attack against President Obama. Right-wingers feel the administration seeks to use Interpol as its own secret police against conservative activists. Yet Interpol doesn't have the right to arrest American citizens. Right-wing overreaction made its way to Capitol Hill as Michigan Republican Congressman Mike Rogers introduced a resolution seeking the repeal of the executive order. Rogers, a former FBI agent, says the order would tie the hands of law enforcement, a claim denied by Interpol. According to Mother Jones magazine, the campaign against the Interpol executive order feeds into other conspiracy theories, like the one claiming that Obama was really born in Kenya and is not an American citizen. Conservative state legislators have introduced state sovereignty bills declaring independence from the federal government under the 10th Amendment and threatening to secede in the event the federal government declares martial law. The Washington Post reports a new gay underground in the U.S. military is growing, while there is increased reluctance by commanders to expel homosexual soldiers under the Pentagon's current Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. In the war zone in Iraq, an email group includes a database for gay and lesbian soldiers to post their instant messaging screen names and the bases where they are posted. In addition, a growing number of gay soldiers have disclosed their sexual orientation to superiors and fellow soldiers. The Pentagon is currently reviewing the policy after President Obama's call for ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell in his State of the Union address. With resources stretched thin in wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, frontline commanders are reluctant to expel gay soldiers who have valuable skills, such as an ability to speak Arabic. Expulsions from Don't Ask, Don't Tell have fallen 30% since the 9/11 terror attacks. Public opinion polls also show strong support for gays serving in the U.S. military. But there is a high level of fear among gay soldiers, and few are expected to come out if the ban on gays in the military is lifted. There is a concern that there could be a negative impact on promotions and evaluations. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The battle for Marja, launched on February 13th by a combined force of more than 15,000, including U.S. Marines, Afghan soldiers, and British troops, is the first major battle following President Obama's escalation of the war in Afghanistan. The goal, according to U.S. officials, is to rout the Taliban from the area and then secure and hold the city. The strategy depends on cooperation from Afghan civilians, and there are reports that many civilians are willing to take steps to push the Taliban out of their communities by reporting their whereabouts to Western military authorities and by refusing to give Taliban insurgents food or shelter. A cornerstone of the effort is to build trust among citizens and avoid civilian casualties. However, in the first days of the assault, a dozen people were reported killed, including at least five children, in one location, and other non-combatant deaths soon followed. In other news from Afghanistan, a joint raid by Pakistan and U.S. intelligence officers reportedly captured the Taliban's top military commander in the Pakistani city of Karachi. But it is uncertain if that arrest would affect the Taliban's capabilities on the battlefield. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Robert Naiman, Policy Director of Just Foreign Policy, which uses online tools to promote citizen activism in the realm of U.S. foreign policy. He explains how Obama's escalation of the war in Afghanistan may not bring about his desired results.
Before the offensive happened, U.S. officials said civilian casualties were inevitable, and of course that was exactly true. The U.S. military forces were going into a densely populated area. It's estimated the population of Marja was between 80,000 and 100,000, and it was reported that most of the civilians had not fled the town. The instruction from the NATO forces to the civilian population was stay in your homes and keep your head down. So that was it. These 12 civilians that were killed, I don't know for sure, but at least five children, according to the New York Times account, they were inside. They were obeying the NATO instructions, and obviously that didn't save them from the U.S. rocket attack. There's no explanation that's been given for why this military assault in the civilian area is justified, given the cost to civilians. Remember that U.S. officials have said that at the end of the day, the way that this is going to be resolved in Afghanistan is not by a U.S. military victory. They've conceded that the U.S. cannot defeat the Taliban militarily. They've conceded that the Afghan Taliban are a permanent part of the political landscape in Afghanistan. They concede that the end game is going to be a negotiated political agreement. So the thing that they haven't explained is how the agreement that they could get 12 months from now, 18 months from now, whenever it is different from the agreement that they could get by starting negotiations today. The Afghan government, President Karzai, has said that he wants political talks now, peace talks now with the senior Afghan Taliban leadership. This is a policy that's been opposed by the United States. So these deaths that are happening now, the deaths of Afghans, deaths, of course, of American soldiers, these additional deaths from the present policy of military escalation can only be justified if you explain what the difference is between the political settlement that's going to result a year from now and the political settlement that could happen today.
Obama is saying the surge will turn the tide, but if the administration concedes all those things about the Taliban, then why do you think he's really doing the surge?
According to them, their logic is they don't want the deal that they could get now. They say, you know, our position is too weak, the Taliban's position is too strong, and we don't want to negotiate from a position of weakness. So first we have to weaken the Taliban. But they haven't explained to the American people or to Congress what that is. The security objective The U.S. national security objective that's been identified by U.S. officials is, you know, it's all about the relationship between the Taliban and al-Qaeda, and it's all about Afghanistan being a base for attacks on the United States. There is strong reason to believe, considerable evidence, that those two things are things that the United States could be negotiating with the Afghan Taliban leadership today. The fact that the United States is not doing that indicates that maybe they have some other objective that they haven't told us besides the relationship between the Taliban and al-Qaeda and the potential threat of Afghanistan being a base of attacks on the U.S. in the future. But that's a question mark because the U.S. officials have never been compelled to answer this question.
But the U.S. has acknowledged that very few members of al-Qaeda remain in Afghanistan. They're all in Pakistan.
Yes, absolutely. Admiral Mullen, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in congressional testimony, said, you know, we estimate that there's not more than 100 al-Qaeda people in Afghanistan, which, of course, that's an embarrassing confession for the U.S., given its policy. You know, we have tens of thousands of ground forces in Afghanistan, and we have, you know, a handful of forces in Pakistan, none of whom are at least officially allowed to engage in any kind of combat. The only thing that the U.S. is officially, semi-officially engaged in is this program of drone strikes in Pakistan. So in the place where the al-Qaeda is believed to be in Pakistan, there's no U.S. war there. In the case where al-Qaeda isn't, there is. In Afghanistan, there is a war. It seems like on the surface of it, it appears that the logic is just inertia. You know, we're already doing it, and we can do it, and so we'll continue to do it until such point as we can do something that we can call victory. But that's not a moral, not a moral basis for what we're doing, which involves, you know, continued deaths of U.S. soldiers and Afghan civilians and billions of dollars every month. The fact that we're doing it already is not a sufficient justification for continuing to do it in the future.
That was Robert Naiman with the group Just Foreign Policy. For more information, visit the group's website at justforeignpolicy.org. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, companies that hired congressional lobbyists in 2009 spent more than $3.47 billion to influence legislators as they debated the future of health care reform, financial regulations, and energy policy. That constituted more than a 5% increase over the previous record expenditure of $3.3 billion spent on federal lobbying in 2008. The center calculated that $1.3 million were spent on lobbying every hour that Congress was in session during 2009. This flood of corporate spending to influence Congress came as the U.S. was suffering through the worst economic decline since the Great Depression. Public opinion polls indicate most Americans aren't happy with the status quo in Washington, with more than 60% saying that federal legislators don't deserve to be reelected. Several other polls find that the public's approval for Congress and political parties are now at historic lows. Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig is co-founder of the nonprofit group Change Congress, whose mission is to restore public trust in government and protect the independence of Congress by fighting the influence of money in politics. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Professor Lessig about how his group proposes to change the status quo in Washington, where big money has veto power over congressional action on behalf of the public good.
Well, it's a kind of corruption that's different from corruption that was pretty common in the 18th and 19th century, the kind of bribery or quid pro quo corruption or the corruption of Rob Blagojevich or Randy Duke Cunningham. This is more a corruption of influence. And it comes because Congress is enormously competitive to each party trying to raise as much money as they possibly can to keep control of Congress. And that means that they spend between 30 and 70% of their time out there raising money, if not for themselves, then for somebody else in their party. And as anybody recognizes, if you're spending that much time focused on what big funders want, you can't help but be corrupted from the underlying job that you're supposed to be doing, which is to be dependent not upon your funders, but upon the people. And so this behavior, this dance that they dance, leads most people to believe that they're, in fact, not so much concerned about what their constituents want and mainly concerned about what makes their funders happy.
Now, with the Supreme Court decision in the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, which really gave carte blanche to big corporations and other less wealthy nonprofit groups to spend as much as they want to influence campaigns, could it be that this kind of swamping of the political system with no holds bar, an infusion of money that the likes of which this country has never seen, could that turn around public apathy and actually involve citizens in trying to change what is, you know, viewed ever more as an untenable anti-democratic system?
It could, and I think it will, if we give the people a clear alternative that they can work for. You know, I think one of the most depressing facts about the Democratic leadership in Congress and the president is that rather than pursuing a bold idea about how to change the system and make it into one that people can believe in again, they're tinkering at the margins. You know, this is the classic arranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. So the Democrats and the president want more transparency. They want to make it easier for people to, the president proposed, track down who got earmarks. And all of those, of course, are good. Nobody would argue against transparency. But the idea that making it easier for people to use the Internet to find out how money affected politics is going to make them believe in politics more is extraordinarily naive. What has to happen is a fundamental change in the economy of influence that governs how members get elected. And what that means is citizen-funded elections. And if we had that, which there are now 135 co-sponsors in the House for a bill that would do exactly that, then at least people could begin to believe that the reason Congress did what it did, whether it, you know, whatever stupid thing they did because they were too liberal or too conservative, but not because of the money. And that's the first step, once again, to restoring faith in this democracy.
Professor Lessig, you point out that this is not just some abstract argument or fight about the ideals of democracy, that there are real-life consequences for us here as a nation and a world. And you point out that with this economic collapse caused in large part by deregulation, propelled by the money in Congress that pushed that deregulation, and the other major environmental issue of climate change and the forces arrayed against changing the current energy system, which will surely get us all into hot water with real dire consequences for life on the planet, that this really is, again, not some kind of parlor game, but there's really life and death issues here.
That's right. And, you know, and I frankly blame all of us for not being more aware of how this systemic problem needs to be solved. You know, we've got to connect the dots. You know, some of us care about healthcare. Some of us care about global warming. Some of us care about, you know, a financial system that doesn't send the economy over the cliff. Whatever you care about, you need to begin to recognize we're not going to get any of this reform until we fix this first problem first. And, you know, people have got to put aside their own personal pet issue and begin to devote the energy we need to focusing on this first problem first. And if we do that, you know, obviously a democracy has the opportunity to make this change, but it's going to require a kind of courage and devotion that, you know, we've not seen in this democracy for many years.
That was Harvard University law professor Lawrence Lessig, director of the Edward J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics and co-founder of the group Change Congress. Visit the Change Congress website at fixcongressfirst.org. Just before the unexpected victory by Republican Scott Brown in the January 19th Massachusetts special election to fill the seat left vacant by the death of Senator Edward M. Kennedy, a union president expressed concern about the anger he was hearing among rank-and-file members toward congressional Democrats. One of the top complaints often heard was about the compromise reached between union officials and Democrats, accepting a tax imposed on union contract-negotiated health care benefits. As a candidate, President Obama had explicitly campaigned against the imposition of such a tax. Brown's defeat of Democratic candidate Martha Coakley, Massachusetts Attorney General, gave Republicans the 41st vote they needed to deny Democrats the 60-vote supermajority they need to block a minority filibuster on health care reform legislation and other issues. AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka, who had accepted the White House-brokered compromise on taxing health insurance, warned in a January speech at the National Press Club, quote, "In 1992, workers voted for Democrats who promised action on jobs, who talked about reining in corporate greed, and who promised health care reform. Instead, we got NAFTA, an emboldened Wall Street, and not much more. In 1994, there was no way to persuade enough working Americans to go to the polls when they couldn't tell the difference between the two parties," end quote. Unions worked hard and spent millions of dollars to elect Barack Obama to the White House and the largest majority in Congress in over 30 years. But many union activists are now feeling as though Democrats are turning their back on labor's top priority agenda items, such as comprehensive and affordable health care reform and passage of the Employee Free Choice Act. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jane Slaughter, a staff writer with the publication Labor Notes. She looks at the causes of growing anger among union activists at Democrats and the possible consequences for the party in the November 2010 midterm elections.
A local union president had a big General Electric local. His name is Jeff Crosby. And he talks about how his members were calling him and emailing him at the union hall and saying, "You guys are not listening to us. Why are you telling us to vote for this person, Coakley, who's going to tax our benefits?" And he quotes active union members who said that they were planning to vote for the Republican. Now, in the end, Coakley only lost the union vote by 3%, but still that's pretty remarkable for a Democrat in Massachusetts. And Jeff Crosby points out that Scott Brown only received 50,000 votes more than McCain, but Coakley received 850,000 fewer votes than Obama did in 2008. So many, many, many Democrats were just too disgusted to come out and vote. They didn't want to hold their nose and vote for a Republican, but they weren't going to vote for the Democrat who would tax their benefits either. So that's why we got the result that we got in Massachusetts. And, you know, everyone's saying it's a wake-up call to the Democrats, but I'm not sure if they're waking up yet.
I wanted to ask you about Richard Trumka, newly elected president of the AFL-CIO, the largest labor federation in the country. Now, Richard Trumka came in for a lot of criticism, as you've described, and I know in this article you talked about a phone conference call among some of the union leaders around the country, and there was a lot of anger at him at the compromises made and some blame placed squarely on his shoulders and other union leader shoulders for the loss in Massachusetts and the botched health care reform. How has Richard Trumka reacted to that, and do you think he deserves that blame?
Well, I would never put something all on the shoulders of one person, seldom. I would say that the whole labor movement really missed its opportunity in 2009. 2009 was the year when bankers and corporations were in very bad repute. Everybody was mad at the bankers. They weren't happy about Congress bailing them out. That spilled over into corporations and insurance companies. I mean, nobody likes the health insurance companies, right? And so it was labor's opportunity to try to rally not only our own members, but you know, the millions and millions of other people who should be union members, you know, working people as well, for a more forward-looking, populist, pro-worker agenda in Congress. And instead of keeping the heat on after the 2008 election, because labor went all out to elect Obama and a Democratic Congress, but then they retired to their tents after that victory and just sort of, you know, assumed that the people that they had elected would do what they said they were going to do. And they didn't, including Obama. Obama directly contradicted one of his most important promises that got union people to vote for him. So instead of keeping the heat on with big demonstrations or big lobbying delegations that actually brought people out or mobilizing people for the town hall meetings, that did happen after a while, they preferred to negotiate behind the scenes inside the Beltway in Washington. You know, they're so excited to have a seat at the table. Oh, our AFL-CIO lobbyists can be at the same table where these insurance company people are. But they got caught up in all that instead of mobilizing the members to make sure that the politicians carried through on their promises. And, you know, there was so much anger out there that was just not channeled into anything. And therefore, we see what we got. We got failed health care reform, and labor's other priority, the Employee Free Choice Act, looks like it's nowhere. You know, you don't even hear any talk about a weak version of that coming up this year. Maybe it will, but this was the time that we could have mobilized all that anger at the powers that be, and we didn't do it.
Well, Jane, what are you hearing about the midterm elections? Labor support for Democratic candidates has been key to victories in the past in terms of the money and the man and woman power on the streets knocking on doors that labor can bring to elections that's difficult to find anywhere else. With some anger at the Obama administration and Congress, despite having a historic majority, the largest majority in about 30 years, is unable to do much for labor, the movement that worked so hard to get this majority, it seems like there's got to be some anger in the winds out there that, you know, could portend a disaster for the Democrats in the midterm election.
Yeah, that's, as I said earlier, 850,000 fewer people in Massachusetts voted for Martha Coakley than voted for Obama. A huge number of people chose to stay home. And I would predict that a big chunk of your diehard labor activists would still be willing to get out there and do the phone banking, the get-out-the-vote efforts. Not all of them, but a big chunk of them will, you know, keep coming back to the Democrats no matter what because they believe the alternative is so much worse. But I think they're going to have a much harder time convincing the rank and file that it's worthwhile to vote for this party that has indicated so little interest. It's sort of like an abusive relationship, you know. The Democrats continually slap labor's demands away, and labor just keeps coming back and coming back and supporting them again and again.
That was Jane Slaughter, a staff writer with the publication Labor Notes. Read her articles online at labornotes.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.